Good morning. I'm Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I call this second meeting of the committee to order. This reminder that this meeting is being held pursuant to House Rule 10.01. And I want to remind members and staff, folks on this call, to remain muted when you're not speaking. And also remind everyone that the meeting materials for this hearing have been posted to our committee's website. And then have also been sent around to members and staff as well. And so welcome, glad to be with everyone again. The plan for this morning is to do the thing that ordinarily would happen on the first day of the session, first meeting of ours, which is to have an introduction to our staff and to our members and hear from folks. And then to have a presentation on brain development, a really critical topic in our work. I want to thank everyone for working through the materials on Tuesday. We had a very full hour and a half addressing early care and learning and other issues during the pandemic, which felt like a really important thing to start with. But we're going to be, as I say, moving to the introductions, and we're going to do the roll call by way of those introductions. And so actually what I want to start with is to hear from our staff first. I'm going to start with our nonpartisan staff to give them a heads up and just want to just hear if we can say your role with the committee and what you do with us and in supporting us with your great work and how long you've been with the House. And maybe if there's other work that you've done with the House, you can mention that as well. And so I'm going to call on Ms. Mock first, who is our nonpartisan House research staff supporting our committee. Ms. Mock. See if we can.
Sorry.
There we go.
Thank you, Mr. No Chair. Problem. I'm Annie Mock. I will learn to press my mute button. I am nonpartisan staff with House Research. My portfolio includes childcare and early learning, and I've been with House Research for about a year.
Thank you. And we're really lucky to have Ms. Mock with us. She's been really, really helpful just in this past year. And so can provide a lot of support for our members. We thank her. And then our House Fiscal staff, we'll start with Ms. Adrians, and then we'll go to Mr. Berg. Emily Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Emily Adrians, and I am part of the House Fiscal staff. And I staff this committee, the Early Childhood Committee, as well as the K-12 Education Finance Committee. And I've been with the House for about 10 years.
Great. Thank you so much. And to Mr. Berg, Doug Berg.
Doug Berg. I'm also on the House Fiscal staff. I staff this committee and the Human Services Finance Committee and the Health Finance Committee. I have been with the House since 1989.
It's we are very lucky to have both you and Ms. Adrians and for our new member and then for members of the public as well to understand that that the three folks we just heard from are part of our amazing team of nonpartisan staff who generally are split in terms of helping us with the policy as Ms. Mock is, and then we've got the folks who are keeping an eye on the fiscal issues for us, and we've got an amazing team here. So thank you to all three of you. And then we actually have both an incoming and an outgoing committee administrator. And so we'll start with Polly Sirkvenik, if you can introduce yourself.
Hello, everybody. My name is Polly Sirkvenik. I am the new Early Childhood Committee Administrator. This is my third session at the House, and I spent the previous two as the committee legislative assistant for this committee and excited to continue working in the area in a new role.
Thank you so much, Mr. Drenick. And then to our outgoing committee administrator, Alyssa Fritz. And if you can describe where you are headed as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alyssa Fritz, and I was the committee administrator for this committee and the Education Policy Committee for the past year, have worked at the House for 2 years, but this is my final week as I am heading to a new position at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, where I'll be supporting the research of Dr. Rachel Hardiman and Dr. Katie Cosimano, who do really leading work on maternal infant health equity research that informs policy. So happy to continue working on these issues and hope to still work with everyone on the committee. And from time to time, it's been a true privilege to be here. So thank you.
Well, and a personal note of gratitude to Ms. Fritz, who's been just incredibly helpful this past year. I'm very sorry to be losing her, though. She's going to be doing incredible work at the U, and lucky to have Mr. Fennick moving on in. So we wish you the very best Ms. Fritz. So then our committee legislative assistant, Shadika Chambers, who is new to the House. And Ms. Chambers, please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Shanika Chambers. I am the new committee legislative assistant. This is my first session here at the House, but before here I was with the House DFL Caucus as a candidate services associate. So I'm very excited to be here and very excited to work with you all.
Glad to have you, Ms. Chambers. Thank you. And then for members of the public, there are research staffers who work with each of the caucuses and really work in a really collaborative way. And so there, we have two of those folks. We'll start with Mars Beltrandi-Rudquist. If you can introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Mars Beltrandi-Rudquist. I work for the DFL Caucus Research Department with this committee, as well as the Education Policy and Education Finance Committees. And this will be my eighth or ninth year working at the House in some capacity. Had a lot of roles here in that time.
Thank you, and to Mr. Withers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jody Withers. I'm with the House Republican Caucus, assisting members with the Early Childhood Committee, Education Policy Committee, and the Education Finance Committee. And I've been with the House Republican Caucus for about 10 years.
Thank you, Mr. Withers. And I'll note that both of those individuals have great expertise, have been really good to work with for me, and then I know supporting their members as well. And so we're really grateful to both of them. And so with that, we're going to turn then to members. And to hear from you all, and if you could share where you're from, where your district is, and how long you've been with the House, and then any thoughts that you have about your interest or connection with the work of this committee and the very youngest Minnesotans. And so we're going to start with the Vice Chair, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great to hear from our staff that supports us, and I just have to echo, I think, what we all feel. And as Ms. Fritz said, it's an honor to work with this group and to have the role that that we do right now. So thank you. Thank you for that all. So my name is Lori Pryor. I represent Southern Minnetonka, Northern Eden Prairie. Our district number is 48A. This is my third term, starting the third term here. And I guess I can say my interest in this committee has been, I'm a grandmother of seven grandkids right now. And so, you know, that's where I know where I am right now is I'm thinking about our future. I'm thinking about all the opportunities that my grandkids have had, that my three kids had growing up, and what a difference that made in their lives. They've all actually, you know, working parents, the child care, the choices that you have to make when you're a working parent, and to know to do what's right for your kids, that never changes. So these are all issues that I feel very much so to the core of my being are important. But also I know being part of the committee last year and listening to the research that we heard at the beginning of that term that we're going to hear again in this morning's session, is I know that that these years are just so critical. Just understanding our science tells us, what I understand as being a parent and a grandparent, just brings it home. So a little bit wandering there, but thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me say that right out there. So thanks all for the work that we're doing here and for being a part of it.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. I appreciate that. So now the minority lead, Representative Franson. I'll just note, because of logistics, Representative Franson is joining us by phone. Representative Franson, please.
Hi there, everyone. Happy Thursday. I'm Mary Franson.
And Representative Franson, anything that you want to add regarding your interest in the committee, et cetera? And no problem if not, it may be challenging. And we can have you do that later if the time may work better for that.
This is, I lost count how many years I've been on early childhood education as a mom. So I have an interest in it. And then, of course, I was a licensed child care provider for a few years before being elected. And I think we all in no matter how we get there, we all want to make sure that our youngest have the tools necessary so that they can, achieve those milestones in life.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Thank you. Then I'm going to call on Representative Bennett. Please, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's so nice to join this committee. I'm Peggy Bennett. I'm starting my fourth term as a state legislator. I represent 27A, which is Southern Minnesota. Albert Lea is our largest city, and we have lots of smaller rural communities, and early childhood is very important to this area. It's near and dear to my heart. I was a teacher. I'm retired now, but was an elementary school teacher for 33 years in Albert Lea, and I taught all primary grades and mostly first grade and special education. I do also have my early childhood certification, though I never taught early childhood per se. The youngest age group I taught kindergarten 1 year, and I just love kids, and I'm excited to be on this committee. I've been on Ed Finance and Ed Policy, my whole time at serving, and this is my education term because now I can add early childhood. So I'm excited, and one of my goals is just to make sure that parents, that families have a lot of options to choose from when they're choosing what early childhood type of opportunity they'd like their child to be in. So just a lot of flexibility there. Learning scholarships, I think, are really nice for that. So I look forward to good discussions on all the early childhood topics. Thank you for having me.
Representative Bennett, very glad to have you joining the committee. Thank you. And then Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am very excited to join this committee. My name is Liz Bolden. I represent District 25B, which is Northern Rochester. I am just starting my first term. And my background is as a nurse. I also have three kiddos, and so come to this work from that standpoint and knowing how important those first years of life are. I really want to do the work of building a just and inclusive Minnesota, and that really starts with, making sure the littlest Minnesotans have what they need and that we are supporting them and their families in the best way possible. So I am very excited to be here and to get to work. Thank you.
Representative Bowman, glad to have you both in the legislature and on the committee. Good stuff. I'm going to call on Representative Daniels, another new member of the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Well, the chair knows how long I've been there because we were, like I said the other day, we were roommates in our training session. And so I'm starting my fourth term. I represent District 24B, which is Faribault, Morristown, Medford, and a couple of small southern towns that actually bump up to Representative Bennett's district. And I love what I do. I have a great community that supports me. And on a side note, my wife did daycare for about 6 years. We found out back when our kids were little that it was, she couldn't make enough money to pay for daycare for three kids. It was physically, financially better to have her stay home and take care of our three and then take care of maybe three or four other ones than it was for her to try to find a job. So I'm very happy to be on the committee and hope we can do some good work. So thank you for having me.
And welcome to you, Representative Daniels. And I'll note our next committee member I'm going to call on is somebody I'm particularly excited to have join us. It's Chair Davney, Representative Davney, the chair of the House Education Finance Committee. And of course, there's a strong connection in the work of these committees. And so please, Chair Davney.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you for the warm welcome. I'm excited to be here. This is the first time I've served on an early childhood committee in my time in the House, although I've been involved with these issues for much of my time in the House, recognizing that many of the racial disparities that we try to put some attention on, insufficient, begin before the kindergartner shows up at class for the first day for that important kindergarten drop-off. but begin, actually, I know if I don't say this, either the chair or Representative Morrison will correct me, begin prenatally. But the early childhood is an important place for us to invest so that we have a Minnesota where everyone gets to thrive. And that's my commitment, is making sure that we have paths for families to access the resources that they need for the best interests of their child and of the state. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. And Representative Dabney, I think, I forget if you mentioned this, but you as well have a background as a classroom teacher, as does Representative Bennett, I think, from older kids. Can you just remind us of that?
Certainly, thank you. I sentenced to serve 17 years teaching primarily middle school. So those of you, I really enjoy developmental psychology. Many of you may recognize the similarities between early childhood and middle school. So perhaps uniquely qualified to serve on this committee in that respect.
Thank you, Representative Downey, and good point. There's significant parallels in those stages of life. I also will just pause to note, because it's so important to do so, Representative Downey mentioned racial disparities, and I am very much hoping that the work of the Select Committee on Racial Justice and the work that was done by that committee in the fall informs all of our work, because as Representative Downey said, it's absolutely critical, in particular for the work of this committee, certainly for all the work of the committees that we're on. But for all kinds of reasons we're going to be discussing, particularly related to our work. I'm going to call on Representative Damuth next. Representative Damuth.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr.
And
Chair.
And the minority lead on that committee, in fact, so a good transition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone, members, staff. It's good to be with you this morning. My name is Representative Lisa Damuth, serving the District of 13A. A portion of Stearns County. I won't break down all my cities and townships, but there's a number of them right in central Minnesota. I am beginning my second term in the legislature. I'm very happy to be here. I did serve on the Early Childhood Committee my first term and excited to continue that work. I, previous to my time in the legislature, I did serve my community as 11 years on my local school board. And I really saw the importance of early childhood. We need to make sure that we are giving our families and our kids the best start that we can. And so I saw the importance of this work. As we started in 2019, our workforce, we had a definite workforce shortage, and a lot of that was attributed to the lack of childcare. So I'm excited to have served, and we are almost done with our work, but on the Family Childcare Task Force, how we can best stand up that industry and make sure that our families have what they need, our providers have what they need, and then our kids are definitely getting what they need. As Chair Pinto mentioned, I did serve as the vice chair of the Select Committee on Racial Justice. Important work done over the summer, over the fall in that area. Look forward to that, continuing those founding principles. But also giving our families the best opportunities to equip their kids, whether that's early learning scholarships, just making sure that they have what they need is kind of my focus for this year. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be here.
Representative Damuth, so glad to have you back, and we will be drawing on your expertise as vice chair of that committee. Thank you so much. Very pleased to have Representative Juergens joining the committee for the first time. And Representative Juergens, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, as you said, my first term on this committee, although I have served with Chair Pinto on the Governor's Advisory Council for the past year or so. I'm excited to be on this committee. I'm a father of two, both adults now. My youngest daughter works in the daycare field, and so this is an interest of hers, and through that, obviously an interest of mine as well. My oldest daughter and her husband live with us with their twin babies that were born almost a year ago, but born 4 months early. So it's been an interesting year watching them develop a part of their life where they normally don't develop outside in the outside world. And so this is, I'm anxious to see the work that we take up in this committee, and I'm glad to be here.
Representative Juergens, welcome. Glad to have you again. And Representative Katiza Witun, I'll call on you next.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, everybody. So pleased to be back on the Early Childhood Committee again for my second term in the Minnesota House. I had the privilege of serving as vice chair in the last biennium, and I'm so thrilled to continue to serve alongside my district partner, Lori Pryor, who is now the current vice chair. So clearly, the passion for early childhood runs strong out in Eden Prairie, Minnetonka. And I am outside the legislature, a mom of four full-time, and my oldest son will be 7. We have a almost 6-year-old, we have a 4.5-year-old, and a 5-month-old. So I'm particularly passionate about the first few years of their lives and making sure that they are equipped to hit kindergarten ready to learn and excited to learn. And my older three children were previously in the Minnesota foster care system. So I am extremely interested in learning how to kind of counteract some of the perhaps early childhood adverse experiences that some Minnesotans go through in their earliest days of life, and making sure that we are able to support them where they need to be supported, so that when they join the public school system and are ready to become workers in Minnesota later on, that they can contribute fully as strong members of our society and our economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Katisa Witun. Though we've lost you as vice chair, we're going to continue drawing on your passion for this work. So glad to have you. Representative Morrison, I'll call on you next.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kelly Morrison. I represent 33B, which includes 10 communities in the Lake Minnetonka area in the western suburbs of Minneapolis. I'm an OBGYN in my other life, and so I have obviously both a professional and a personal interest in prenatal development and also in evidence-based policymaking. And boy, there is a huge body of evidence that suggests that this is exactly where we should be investing our resources. So I'm thrilled to be a member of this committee and look forward to the work ahead. Thank you.
Representative Morrison, glad to have you. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Wasilewicz, calling you next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. My name is Amy Wasilewicz. I am a representative from District 38B, which includes the communities of Wiper Township, Delwood, North Oaks, and parts of Hugo and White Bear Lake, northeast suburbs of St. Paul. And I am coming into my second term here and my second time on this committee. Glad to be back. I have a particular interest in early childhood from my days of graduate school, when I went to a presentation by Art Rolnick on the benefits of early childhood, and that was what sparked my interest. I also work in childcare, a school-based childcare program outside of the legislature, and so that's childcare is another interest of mine, and I serve as the co-chair of the Family Child Care Task Force with Senator Kiffmeyer. So that's part of my interest in the child care part as well.
And thank you, Representative Wasilewicz, in particular for that work leading the Family Child Care Task Force. It's really important and tough, and appreciate it. And then last but certainly not least, joining our committee anew is Representative Wolgamott.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members, and good morning, staff. My name is Dan Wolgamott, and I'm very proud to serve District 14B, which includes North St. Cloud, East St. Cloud, Minden Township, and Haven Township. This is my first time getting to serve on this committee, but early childhood, early learning has long been a passion of mine. It's very personal for me. I currently am the dad of an early learner. My daughter, Polly, is a preschooler. And so every day I get to see the miracle work that happens. The beautiful growth of our little minds, and there's just nothing more magical and nothing more heartwarming, but also nothing more important in making sure that all Minnesotans are prepared to get the best start in life that they can. And I'm excited to be on this committee. I think that investing in early learning is one of the smartest investments that we can make as a state. Not only is it the right thing to do for the kids, but it's the right thing to do for all of us, for all Minnesotans. So I'm looking forward to working with each of you to tackle racial disparities. I'm looking forward to working with you to make sure that all little Minnesotans, no matter what they look like, no matter where they live, that every little Minnesotan gets the best start possible in life and is set up for success. That's why I'm excited to be on this committee, and that's why I'm excited to work with each and every one of you to make that happen.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. And hearing you and everybody else, I'm really excited and inspired to get to work. This is good stuff. I'm in my fourth term, just to finish introducing myself. And I've had an interest in this work. This really was the particular motivation to cause me to decide to run in the first place, and have been trying to do this work throughout my time in the legislature. I serve outside the legislature as a prosecutor. I think many of you know, and a lot of that work has been in domestic violence. And so seeing some ways in which things can really spiral in the wrong direction, and felt from the very beginning that it made sense to go back to the very beginning of life and try to help get folks on a different path. And I'll maybe just share that that in my view, just thinking about the work of this committee, that there really is no more critical time than those earliest years, and that every single person hearing my voice, although you certainly wouldn't remember it, the fact is that the first 12 months of your life were the most critical. The first 36 months were the most critical 36 months. That's a critical time and a critical infrastructure for our society, both in the short run and then certainly in the long run as well. And where else do you get something that has that kind of double payoff? We need to have a system in place so that parents can work and employers can do what they need to do on that side of things. But as I would think, much more importantly, we have this long-term support to get all of us off to a good start. And then the other side of that I think we need to be focusing on is the fact that this is a deeply under-resourced and fragmented area, not just in terms of money, but even in terms of attention, which is why it was really important to me to have this committee be founded, and to have us all be really focused on those earliest years. We will be looking at some topics in this committee that range a little bit to make sure that we all have the knowledge base that we need to be thinking and to really be focusing on those earliest years. And so as part of that, then, I'm really pleased that we have an expert with us today. And one of the advantages I'll note of having this Zoom platform is that we can have people join us from other locations. So Dr. Pat Levitt is going to be our presenter today. And Dr. Levitt is joining us from California, from Los Angeles, where it is just about to be 7 a.m. And so grateful to him for taking the time with us. Dr. Levitt, we often don't do this with legislative introductions, but I just want to take a second to note that he's the chief scientific officer at the Saban Research Institute Children's Hospital, Los Angeles, as well as a professor of neurogenetics at the Keck School of Medicine at University of Southern California, and is the editor-in-chief of Mind, Brain, and Education, and is very involved in the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard, and the co-scientific director of the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child, and many, many, many more accolades and credentials, as I'm sure you all can imagine. But I asked Dr. Levitt to join us today to really lay a solid foundation for us in understanding how critical these years are and what we need to know in terms of brain development. With that, I will turn things over to Dr. Levitt, who'll be presenting to us, and then we'll have some Q&A. So, Dr. Levitt.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Can you see my slide?
It's part of your foot. There we go. Yes, I can, and I'm assuming that other members can as well. Members of the
public. Okay. Well, I was thinking about how to start my. Well, first of all, it's great to be with you. Representative Pinto knows that Professor Gunner and I are on the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child. She was the director for a very long time for the Institute for Child Development at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And Art Rolnick and I, spent some time with our council early on in the early and mid 2000s when we started, when Jack Shonkoff started the council. And so I know Art very well. Minnesota really has fabulous individuals, extremely dedicated to changing how we've operated for years in this country, which is to in put most of our investment later and put very little investment early. And Art's made a cogent argument about why, from an economic and business perspective, that makes no sense. And hopefully today, with the science that I'll cover, it will do what Representative Pinto wanted to occur, which is to start with a strong foundation, just like children need to start with a strong foundation. Let me see. Here we go. So I'm going to spend about 30 minutes talking about a number of topics that I hope flow reasonably well at this early hour for me. Early adversity has lifespan consequences. The science of early child and brain development. Why? You know, what are the mechanisms that are involved in influencing child and brain development? Easy and yet complex, the role of healthy relationships in this process. Certain skills matter most in developing resilience. We'll talk about executive function and why that's so important and how it develops over a long period of time. And then I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. So there was a paper that came out in JAMA Pediatrics, Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics, that came out in 2018 to monitor the prevalence of adverse childhood experiences. This was a very large survey from 23 states. This had been done by the CDC at earlier periods of time, and states have done this as well in terms of doing surveys, but this was a relatively large one. They used a surveillance system that has been validated, and what they found is that when they surveyed adults, 62% report at least one adverse childhood experience, 25% reported three or more. It's about twofold higher exposure in African-American and multiracial ethnicities. And there are other factors that increase exposure to adverse childhood experiences. Very low income is risk, low education achievement in the family, extended unemployment, which increases stress and anxiety in the family, gay, lesbian, and bisexual individuals. So that the numbers you see here in terms of 25% reporting three or more are higher in all of these groups. And so you know from the Kaiser study, and this has been replicated now over and over, this is work from Scotland, but I could show this from any country that's done these studies. If you look at the prevalence of ACEs, four or more we know is devastating in terms of health. And I'm not gonna read through the bottom in terms of the diseases, but adverse childhood experiences has a lifespan effect on physical and mental health. We tend to think of this as a brain-specific set of experiences that are occurring, and certainly the brain and brain development is affected, but it's the whole body that gets affected by adverse childhood experiences. I should say,
Dr. Love, I was just going to know, we may have members or certainly members of the public who may not be familiar with what a quote adverse childhood experience is. I do want to note to members of the public that we'll be having a presentation on ACEs next week. But if you wouldn't mind, just one sentence, just sort of examples of when you say ACEs, what kind of thing that's referring to.
I have
to
a slide coming up on that. And
good. Okay.
It was categorized by the Kaiser study back in the 1990s that Vincent Fippoletti and his coworkers did. And it's abuse, neglect, food insecurity, limited resources. It's expanded to include environmental exposures, contaminants, et cetera, which is an early adverse experience. I mentioned food insecurity, limited resources that create a high anxiety and high stress. And one of the most important things in thinking about early adversity and adverse childhood experiences is that it typically The more difficult ones that have the biggest impact are those that are unpredictable. So abuse and neglect, for example, has an unpredictability to it in terms of when it's going to occur. And unpredictability, if you think about it in your own life, if you know that something was coming that's going to create anxiety or stress, you try to figure out how to adapt and buffer to that before it actually happens. If you don't know what's coming, it has really much more profound physiological effects. So so if you look at child developmental delays, I picked this slide because children with developmental delays typically end up in special needs classrooms. And from an education system perspective and an economic perspective, this is extremely difficult for states to manage, because the education of a child in a special needs classroom is about 5 to 7 times more expensive than it is for a typically developing child. And so you can see that by the time you get to 7 risk factors, adverse childhood experience factors, you're at 100%. So it has a pretty devastating effect in terms of just developmental milestones, et cetera, that occur up into school age. So there's my frown face. But because the story gets even more challenging to think about. So another paper came out in JAMA Pediatrics about prevalence of developmental screening and surveillance in early childhood. Any kind of a screen for any kind of a developmental challenge that a child may have. What's the prevalence of pediatricians actually doing this screening? So the screening was done between 9 and 30. The assessments were done in terms of the prevalence, 9 to 35 months. A large survey. The average across the nation is 30% of children are screened with any kind of a screening tool, right? Any kind of a screening tool. So it's very broad. The states range from 17% to 59%. If you want to know the state that has the most has the highest screening at 59%. It's Oregon, which about 10 years ago was about 45th. So they saw this data about 10 years ago and made some major changes. If you include verbal surveillance, where the pediatrician talks to the caregiver about a developmental issue, it's about 37%. So if you turn the statistics around, I don't want to blow your mind with all these numbers early in the morning, but in California it's about 55%. That means 45% of kids in between this 9 and 36 month range are not being screened for anything. They come in, they do a well baby visit, and then they go. And you know, if you think about it, what's the impact of not measuring your blood glucose levels when you go for a physical exam? Let's say you have high glucose, but no one screens for it, right? So the outcome, of course, is diabetes, right? As opposed to identifying a problem early on and being able to manage it before it becomes a full-blown major issue. So factors that reduce screening, it's much less prevalent screening based on ethnicity, income, and parental education as well. So community pediatric clinics that are dealing with in California on the Medi-Cal, the screening numbers are even worse. So I think we're in big trouble because of this issue of not recognizing how deficient we are and even identifying children early on during infancy and early toddlerhood that may be having issues. So in some ways, I think about what we've done on the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child. These are all the wonderful scientists who are on this. And the focus of this council is to basically translate science for policymakers like yourself. Here's what the science says. I'm not a policymaker, and so I don't tell policymakers what to do. I just tell them, here's what we know about development. Use this information as best you can in your communities, in your state, to be able to make wise decisions about investments. And If you believe that our most prized natural resource is our next generation, then you can use the science in a positive way.
A child's experiences during the earliest years of life have a lasting impact on the architecture of the developing brain. Genes provide the basic blueprint, but experiences shape the process that determines whether a child's brain will provide a strong or weak foundation for all future learning, behavior, and health. During this important period of brain development, billions of brain cells called neurons send electrical signals to communicate with each other. These connections form circuits that become the basic foundation of brain architecture. Circuits and connections proliferate at a rapid pace and are reinforced through repeated use. Our experiences and environment dictate which circuits and connections get more use. Connections that are used more grow stronger and more permanent. Meanwhile, connections that are used less fade away through a normal process called pruning. Well-used circuits create lightning-fast pathways for neural signals to travel across regions of the brain. Simple circuits form first, providing a foundation for more complex circuits to build on later. Through this process, neurons form strong circuits and connections for emotions, motor skills, behavioral control, logic, language, and memory during the early critical period of development. With repeated use, these circuits are more efficient and connect to other areas of the brain more rapidly. While they originate in specific areas of the brain, the circuits are interconnected. You can't have one type of skill without the others to support it. Like building a house, everything is connected, and what comes first forms a foundation for all that comes later.
So the beginning of that process actually starts prenatally. And so people ask me, what are the most important periods of time? And I say, well, you know, there's this range, but I say, you know, starting healthy prenatally in terms of the developmental process is so critical in terms of establishing a foundation for what's going to happen in terms of experience dependent development. And keep in mind, for example, that when they in that video you saw, they talked about nerve connections, synapses that are being formed, and the brain interconnects with each other. There are trillions of those connections that are formed starting in the third trimester. Through the first 3 years after birth, an infant, prenatally, an infant is forming about 1 to 2 million synapses a second. Not a minute, not an hour, not a day, 1 to 2 million synapses a second. And so it's in fact, it's for me, it's always been mind-blowing, even though I've been studying development for many, many years. That tells you how rapidly the process is occurring over this period of time. And it should come as no surprise when you think about the changes that occur so rapidly in terms of an infant from birth to 1 year of age, and how incredible it is in terms of the skill sets that they take on within a very short period of time. So we know that brain plasticity, the influence of experience, starts out very high early and decreases over time. It doesn't get to zero because we know that we can still learn and we can still use our experiences to have an impact on how we operate, you know, through the lifespan. But in order to exhibit change, it takes a huge amount of physiological efforts the longer you wait. And so if you were an economist, you would say, well, I want to be at the very high part of that curve because I know that it's going to take less resources, less effort to get the biggest bang for the buck, the biggest change. So early experience drives brain development. And the other thing I think I want to say is that we inherit genes from our parents, and genes are designed, they're designed specifically to be influenced by experience. They don't operate by themselves. They have parts of the genes are coding for proteins that do the work of the cell. But other parts of the genes are what we call regulatory parts that either allow the gene to be turned on or turned off. And experiences have an enormous impact on when genes are turned on and when they're turned off. And so you can't have one without the other. It's not genes or environment that are important. It's both of them. And we know that there are normal ranges in terms of when specific milestones are reached. That's a normal part of development. Some children walk at 8 months. Some children don't start walking until 13 or 14 months. That heterogeneity makes it a bit more challenging when you think about it in terms of identifying issues based on, you know, our traditional milestones. So we start to incorporate other measures to understand whether a child is experiencing early life stress and early adversity. So there's my granddaughter. I have five grandchildren. She's the youngest. This is Camilla is my daughter's youngest. There she is. At about a month, you can figure out which one is the month and which one is the year. She's wearing a tag that says 12 months. And look at the changes that occur in 12 months, right? It's just remarkable in terms of how rapidly development occurs. And given that we know from science that experiences are driving this process, therefore the conclusion needs to be that those experiences, if they're positive, are going to drive positive developmental trajectories. If they're negative, they're going to drive negative developmental trajectories. More on that in a little bit.
The key to forming strong brain architecture is what's known as serve and return interaction with adults. In this developmental game, new neural connections form in the brain as young children instinctively serve through babbling, facial expressions, and gestures. And adults return the serve, responding in a very directed, meaningful way. It starts very early in life, when a baby coos and the adult interacts and directs attention to a face or hand. This interaction forms the foundation of brain architecture upon which all future development will be built. It helps create neural connections between all the different areas of the brain, building the emotional and cognitive skills children need in life. For example, here's how it works for literacy and language skills. When the baby sees an object, the adult says its name. This makes connections in the baby's brain between particular sounds and their corresponding objects. Later, adults show young children that those objects and sounds can also be represented by marks on a page. With continued support from adults, children then learn how to decipher writing and eventually to write themselves. Each stage builds on what came before. Ensuring that children have adult caregivers who consistently engage and serve in return interaction, beginning in infancy, builds a foundation in the brain for all the learning, behavior, and health that follow.
Predictability, security, engagement, interaction, whether it's the primary caregiver or whether it's a daycare center, predictability, consistency are so important in establishing what we've called on the council, we developed this term back in, I think, 2005, along with toxic stress. Serve and return is probably the most critical element in the experiences that an infant has to build healthy brain and body during that period of time. So you heard about language. There are multiple studies that have shown this, that at around 16 months, There's no difference in terms of vocabulary use, babbling and vocabulary use. Things start to split around 24 months. And by 36 months, there's a huge word gap. And if you heard from the video, language is not learned by placing a child in a room with an audio tape. It's learned through social engagement. Cognitive development depends upon social engagement. And the video was purposeful in making sure people understand that that learning language, learning other skill sets, cognitive development has a highly social component to it. So we think about school readiness. sociability is an enormous part of the developmental process that has to occur in the first 3 years of life. This is conserved across species. I don't know if this picture was taken in Minnesota or not, but these are songbirds. There are about 2,000 species. Each male has a unique song that attracts the female to mate. From a biological perspective, from an evolutionary perspective, if the male adult doesn't learn the song, the appropriate song for their species, they don't mate. That's a problem if you want to continue the species from one generation to the next, right? And so who teaches the juvenile? So the juvenile male needs to learn the song before they go through puberty. It's the male, adult male, that teaches the juvenile the song. So the juvenile, over a period of a few weeks, will learn this song. So scientists got creative and they said, well, they're just listening to the patterns of the song, so we'll record the song and play it for the juvenile. And they did that in the absence of the adult being on the perch with the juvenile, and the juvenile did not learn the song. Then they said, well, maybe they need to see a visual cue of the adult. So they took a stuffed bird that looked just like the real adult bird, and they put it on the perch. They put a little microphone in the back of the stuffed bird and played the song. And the juvenile bird did not learn the song, right? And so these kinds of experiments have been done over and over again to demonstrate that language, in this case, it's communication, because birds don't have language, but they do communicate with each other, need that social engagement. So it's serve and return. The engagement, the social interaction tunes the infant's attention system. It creates motivation because there's rewarding aspects to social engagement that the infant has and experiences. And what we know from a number of studies, here's just one example, 24-month-old children with larger vocabularies display greater academic and behavioral functioning at kindergarten entry. It's pretty clear that it's not just the number of words, but their vocabulary is larger because their engagement with caregivers is greater and spend more time in serve and return. That's what's creating their readiness for academic and behavioral functioning in terms of being able to emotionally regulate, to deal with the sort of common stresses that a 4 or 5-year-old might deal with when they go into pre-K or into kindergarten. So it's not just the number of words, it's the interactions that they have to get to that point of having a larger vocabulary. So here's what we were talking about before. This is from the Department of Health and Human Services back in 2010. The numbers are still about the same. This surprises a lot of people. Most adverse childhood experiences are in the form of neglect, the absence of serve and return. That's what neglect is the absence of serve and return. And it makes it more difficult in some ways, because if you talk to clinicians and social workers about what is being screened in child protective services, it generally is abuse. It generally is things that you can see. You can't see neglect unless it's frank neglect, where the child are also malnourished, and then it becomes obvious. But by and large, it's difficult to identify neglect because it's the absence of something that makes it much more difficult to identify. This accounts for close to 80% of adverse childhood experiences. And that means that attention in programs, early investments, are not just about targeting the infant, but it's targeting the caregiver as well, to provide them with the abilities and the skill sets to be able to do serve and return in a healthy way.
Built into our biology is the need to have responsive interactions with adults.
Neglect for children is when they don't get what the brain is expecting to get, what the child is expecting to get, what we are biologically prepared and waiting for, which is input from those around us.
It's this back and forth serve and return interaction that literally shapes the architecture of the brain.
Serve and return, a child looks at something or observes something, makes an utterance, and that represents the serve. And the return is when the parent notices the child doing these things. and responds to the child.
Under conditions where serve and return is broken, you literally are pulling away the what is the essential ingredient of the development of human brain architecture.
It was a really compelling series of experiments where they started by videotaping the mother and the baby engaging in cooing and smiling. And then they asked the mother to basically put on a blank face and not respond at all. When a baby is not attended to, that is a sign of danger to the baby biologically. So the stress systems become activated. In a brain that is constantly bathed in stress hormones, not this up and down that comes with normal development, certain key synapses, the connections between nerves, fail to form, and critical regions of the brain.
So neglect both fails to provide the stimulation that's needed to develop the basic architecture, and when it's at a certain level, is one of the most potent activators of the stress biology of a young child. So you get a double whammy.
So we've done, we do that experiment in our laboratory. We use that. We do what's called free play still face, where we have the mom start for 2 minutes playing with the infant, and then 2 minutes where if the infant can last that long, because we stop the still face when the infant gets upset. And then there's a reunion that occurs after that. And it's remarkable. It's one of the most repeatable outcomes that you can do in an experiment that I've ever done. It's within 15, 20 seconds. There are some infants that don't show that response, and we're trying to understand how that correlates with other developmental issues that the infant may have, and that there may be a problem in terms of neglect, because the infant, you know, the normal response is for the infant to get upset. It's really remarkable. So what matters is that children need to grow up in an environment of relationships that promote critical skill building. And so I was on the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine Committee that put out this report. It's about 800 pages. I highly recommend it. Both if you're having trouble sleeping or if you want a greater detailed information called Vibrant and Healthy Children. And one of the points that's made is that programs that are inclusive in targeting skill set development in caregivers as well as children, infants, and toddlers deal with things much better, the outcomes in terms of those intervention programs are much better. So addressing environmental factors and addressing skill building for the caregiver and the child. 1 in 6 children in the United States is food insecure. 1 in 5 children in the United States lives in poverty. Those numbers are devastating, just devastating.
Science tells us that brains, minds are built, not born. And at the center of this dynamic architecture are a set of skills called executive function and self-regulation.
Children's self-regulation and executive function are key ingredients in their lifetime performance. It's not just about learning language or learning numbers or learning colors. We have to be able to work effectively with others, with distractions, with multiple demands. These actually are skills that contribute to the productivity of the American workforce.
Look at your shapes. What should you have done next?
Educators, I think, are looking for just this sort of thing. And when we describe what we mean by executive function, they say, yes, that's it. That's exactly, you know, the problem. These kids, they can tell me these rules, but they can't actually use them.
What's this?
A toolbox.
A toolbox.
What is executive function?
Sit down.
Sit
safety goggles.
Probably the best way to think about it is sort of like an air traffic control system in the brain. Just like an air traffic control system has to manage lots of airplanes going on lots of runways and really exquisite timing and so on, a child has to manage a lot of information and avoid distractions. We really think of it as involving working memory and inhibitory control and mental flexibility. Take a situation where a child is having to take turns. So first of all, the child has to have inhibitory control. The child has to be able to stop whatever he or she is doing and let the other child take a turn. But when it's your turn again, you also have to remember what it is you're supposed to be doing. So that pulls on working memory. If the children who are taking the turns after you do something unpredictable, you have to be able to adjust what you're going to do next. And that requires mental flexibility. Children who are struggling with these capacities often look like children who just aren't paying attention or children who are deliberately not controlling themselves.
If you don't have self-regulation, you act out and the teacher puts you in timeout. And so then you miss part of the learning that's going on. And then you are more upset because you're behind. And so you act out. And so you get this downward spiral.
How does executive function develop?
4, 6, 7, 7, and plus 4.
In little children, and even, you know, in the infant and toddler years, you begin to see the roots of executive functioning skills. What's going on in our brains is unbelievably intricate and complicated.
The prefrontal cortex, or the front third of the brain, is important for executive function. But it's more than just prefrontal cortex. This region doesn't act alone. It's involved in controlling your behavior through its interactions with all other parts of the brain. The brain goes from a situation where you've got nearest neurons communicating very strongly with each other and ignoring the rest of the brain to these widespread networks that are connecting these different areas. Executive function changes over the life course. It improves radically over the first few years.
I got a match time.
It continues to improve throughout adolescence. It's not until early adulthood that you have the adult type networks that are very strongly activated that connect different brain regions together.
Let's take notes.
Also, we believe that executive functions can be trained.
It's just like going to the gym. So the more you practice in these areas, the stronger the capacity is likely to become because you're helping to strengthen those neural connections.
So I showed that because I wanted to make a, this is a really important point. Executive function is the key skill set that provides the caregiver with the abilities to understand how to be flexible in terms of child rearing and dealing with the child, infant and toddler and young child in different situations, improves their own inhibitory control or impulse control. So you're all familiar with the marshmallow test. You've probably seen those videos where you have children, preschoolers, 3 or 4 year olds sitting at a table. You know, if you put a marshmallow in front of them and say, if you wait 10 minutes, there may be more, you'll get more than just this one. But if you take this one, there's not gonna be any more. Who shows the impulse control to be able to say, okay, I can wait 10 minutes. I have the patience for that. And the most important thing is that it continues to develop into an individual's 30s executive function. The frontal lobe is the most immature part of the brain. It also occupies the largest part of the brain, and it continues to develop, which means that caregivers, right, in their teens, 20s, even into their 30s, can improve on this skill set. That's not true for language. If you want to learn a second language, and the insanity of what we do in this country of starting most second language education in schools is in junior high school. Of course, that's past the critical period or the period of time when the brain is most plastic to learn language. If you go to Europe, they start teaching second languages when the child is 3, 4, 5 years old. And if you've ever been there or met somebody who was born in Europe and then comes to the States, you say, how is it that you can speak 4 or 5 languages? Well, they start it when the brain is most plastic. Executive function, that area of the brain and the connections continues to be plastic. And the areas that control impulse control, mental flexibility, regulation of stress responsiveness are these structures here in the brain, the amygdala, hippocampus, prefrontal cortex, the frontal lobe. And I'm going to show you the parts of the brain that control learning and memory. So pay attention to this next slide.
And Professor, I want to just know, we should probably wrap up in the next couple minutes if we can, to make sure we have plenty of time for questions. Thanks.
Got it. So here's memory and learning. Here's anxiety and fear. It's the identical brain part. It's the identical brain area. So when early adverse experiences are damaging brain architecture in these areas, it's impacting the infant's ability to emotionally regulate and control their fear and anxiety systems, as well as their cognitive systems. So we know that early disruption of executive functions has long-term expensive problems. This is a study that was done in New Zealand, a prospective study. They started with 1,000 individuals. They're now in their 50s, and they have still about 950 who are still part of the study. Poor health outcomes are predicted in adults with low executive function in 2-year-olds. So they have that data. High executive function demonstrates that they actually have positive health outcomes. Adult criminal convictions. Look at the difference between low executive function in 2- and 3-year-olds and higher executive function. And look at the rate of adult criminal convictions. And here are the costs. You've all seen these already. Art Rolnick can go through these numbers a lot better than I can. And the other thing I want to emphasize is that we know that early life stress has not just an impact on the developing brain, but it also has an impact on the developing immune system and our gut and our microbiome and our metabolic systems. And eventually, because the immune system goes on high activation as well, our heart and cardiovascular systems. That's why you see the adult outcomes from early adverse experiences causing these physical health problems. I'm going to skip that. So I'm going to end with this video. Okay, Dave, I'll end with this. This is a remarkable example. This is a 3-year-old. See if you can pick out all the major pieces to executive function. You see what he just did? He just got up to reposition himself, right? Simple exercise, right? Trying to stack these blocks. Working memory, the recognizing the relationship between sizes of blocks. I think he's about 2.5, actually. The mental flexibility to realize that the stack is not working. He's got a bigger block on a smaller block. When I was his age, I would have knocked the tower down already out of frustration, inhibitory control. Look at all the children in the classroom that are not going around and bothering them. persistence, relatively calm, not stressed out about the fact that, boy, this has taken a long time. Here you go. I show this to big, I've given talks to chambers of commerce and business leaders, and they're like, you know, like universities want to sign a sixth grader to come to their university if they look like they're a great athlete. Business leaders want to sign this kid up because that's what they want. So supportive, responsive relationships, strengthen core life skills, executive function, and reduce sources of stress. That's the recipe for successful programs, early childhood programs. And those can take various forms in terms of success for improving health, development, educational achievement, and responsive caregiving and economic stability. Here's my favorite quote from Einstein. If you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got. Thanks very much. I'm happy to answer whatever questions you may have.
Dr. Levin, thank you so much. If we were in person, I know there would have been resounding applause when that final block went on the very top of the tower. And also, thank you for having some of those videos that came after the video of the poor baby whose mom had the blank face. Because I think, talk about feeling stress. I think that many of us on the early childhood, at least I was, I think all of us, right, when you see the mom with the blank face, you just... Anyway, so thank you for that. So a number of questions we've got. Chair Dabney, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Levitt, thank you for getting up awfully early to come and join us. That was an excellent presentation. That little guy's ability to focus when there was so much activity going on around him was really striking to me in that last video. Yep. You touched on some on early literacy and the importance of the caregiver-child relationship and the development of that. And we talk a lot about early literacy. We talk a lot less about early numeracy. And yet I would argue that's probably equally critical, but maybe developed differently. I wonder if you have any insights you could share, because my understanding is the kid who does well at early numeracy, when we get to third grade, also does better not only in math, but also reading. And that's so true. If you can help me with any of that. Thank you, sir.
And Dr. Levin, thank you, Representative Dabney. And Dr. Levin, before you answer, I just want to note for members, you can use the raise hand feature in Zoom to indicate if you wish to ask a question. And then Dr. Levin will call on you.
Yeah, so that's absolutely accurate. That fluency that's learned early on in numeracy has broad cognitive impacts in terms of abilities in language and in reading as well. That's learned. So there are equivalent numbers of studies that have looked at number literacy and the importance of serve and return in terms of learning those concepts as there are in terms of word and language development. Word and language development in terms of those studies were initiated earlier historically, but in terms of the same skill sets or different skill sets being developed through the same mechanism of learning these concepts in a social set of experiences has been demonstrated both for word literacy and number literacy as well. I don't know if it's clear about what the mechanisms are that facilitate other domains other than number literacy that facilitate those other areas, but there are strong correlations. And it's pretty clear that it's been replicated over and over again. And so if you look at that video that I had on executive function, you can see that there was vocabulary and number literacy components that were part of that process of working memory that was being developed in those children, as well as mental flexibility.
Representative, do you have any follow-up?
No, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Levitt.
Okay. And before I call on the next person, just members, the raise hand feature, in case you're having trouble finding it, I think as we move to the reactions area of your Zoom, and Representative Pryor will call on you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the part of it great information, some of it a review of those of us that were fortunate to have been on the committee in the previous term with Dr. Gunnar from the University of Minnesota. And you're consistent. We really appreciate that. You experts are consistent on what you're telling us. But I want to maybe go back a little bit and talk some more, if you're able to, about what you said earlier on in your talk here this morning about screenings. Because it seems to me that, you know, that is something that's part of public policy, is to be aware of, as a state, how we're doing on screenings. And then if you could talk a little bit more about, what values screenings have, especially because connecting up with what you said about neglect, and what interventions, the other part of it is this, it's a process. So you can do a screening and say, okay, here's a problem. And then that can be documented. But then, especially states that do well on this, how you follow up with a screening to have the right kind of interventions to support the family that you're serving. So, thank you for being with us this morning. So appreciate it.
I think that's a great question. So, I'm in the midst of writing a grant with people in the School of Social Work and in occupational therapy for doing a study on the effectiveness of telehealth screening for early risk for autism spectrum disorder, 9 to 15 months, a referral to something called Parents as Teachers, which is a national program that's a telehealth home visitation program, although it's been modified with COVID. They're not going to the homes, but there's training of the caregivers, right, in terms of administering the interventions to their child. It's mostly been done in terms of literacy and developmental milestones and things like that, and that they have a module now for autism. And no one's really studied it very well in terms of how effective it is. And we're having this conversation, and the School of Social Work folks, who do a lot of implementation and effectiveness research, say, well, screening is an intervention. I'm like, what do you mean screening is an intervention? Like, if you measure glucose and you don't do anything and then you don't give insulin, is that? And it turns out that it is an intervention. If you think about it this way, that screening will translate into a larger number, not an absolute complete 100% number, a larger number of those who will end up getting services, which will be the effective intervention. So screening in the absence of having a connection to an intervention service is quite limited. That screening generally either connects to referrals to interventions, or it forces the system to develop greater capacity for interventions. What we are doing, and what many people are doing, and Professor Gunnar is involved in this as well, is doing really early screening in the first 2 years after birth, with the idea that an intervention that's required early on to facilitate positive development, right, with the caregiver and the infant, is going to require shorter duration and less intensive therapies than if you wait until there are problems in second, third, fourth, and so on. So the math, when you do it in terms of, well, how much shorter is the intervention going to have to be? That's what people are doing now. So the idea is the screening will increase access to services, and it will force the system to develop services that are going to be targeted specifically to this age area, to this developmental period, 0 to 2, 0 to 3. And because plasticity and the effect of experiences has a much greater effect early, the programs are much shorter. So we have, for example, at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, we have a behavioral health program that spans all medical disciplines. So if you're a 3-year-old getting cancer treatment, God forbid, there's also a psychologist that's working with the caregivers, the parents, and the child as well, because infants have and toddlers have mental health as well. And it turns out that, you know, an 8-10 week program is incredibly effective in changing the trajectory, as opposed to what may have to happen if you wait later, where you're talking about 1, 2, 3 years or continuous services because the response is not very good. That makes sense? Yeah. So you can't have one without the other. I just want to, so screening is critically important, but connecting that services that are going to be targeted is has to go hand in hand. And there's a worry that we'll, you know, if we're good at screening, maybe we'll flood the system and there won't be enough services. But the investment on the service side will actually save money in the end, because you won't need those services later on. If you look at how much social support dollars are spent, right, about 80% of it is spent in this country and in Canada. That's where the studies have been done that I'm familiar with. About 80% of it is spent on people 65 and older. Now, I'm older than 65, so but I would still complain about it, because that needs to shift earlier.
And I'll note, Dr. Levitt referenced Dr. Gunner. That's Megan Gunner, who's the director of our Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. And folks may remember who on the committee she presented 2 years ago, and she is the person who suggested Dr. Levitt. So we're really lucky to have her as a national expert in our state. Representative Juergens, we'll call on you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Levitt, first of all, I just want to thank you so much for being here with us today. I really appreciate it. I don't know if you heard the introductions or not, but I have grandchildren that were micro preemies. They were born at 23 weeks and they live with us, and they're twins, a boy and a girl. They're going to be a year old here in a couple of weeks, but they're more developmentally, they're more like 8-month-old babies. So they're just starting to crawl and scoot around and sit up and things like that. You could do an entire semester on that topic, I'm sure. But if you could give me one piece of advice to help close that gap between, you know, their gestational age and their true age, what would that advice be?
Dr. Levitt.
Yeah, so preemies are at, you know, greater risk for developmental trajectories like what you're talking about if there's not attention paid to really developing strong server return in interactions. If you think about server, it's a very simple concept. You're doing things with your grandchildren in terms of their motor development, where you may be playing with them and you're moving their legs so that their motor development and cognitive development go hand in hand. Those interactions are priceless in terms of the impact that they're gonna have on development. And so the traditional amount of time that one spends with a preemie is not as effective as increasing those serve and return activities. Keep in mind that serve and return is not just about you as the adult initiating the interactions, but interacting in a way where you get responsiveness from your twins so that they're doing the serve as well. Think about it. If you were, you know, playing a tennis game or whatever, or throwing a ball and, you know, the other person was doing all the initiation. It gets pretty boring after a while. And that's how an infant feels, right? So doing activities that generate their interest in doing the serving is very effective in terms of the developmental components, particularly motor development for the preemies, is really important. We know that motor maturation is connected to sociability and cognitive development as well. People are surprised when I say that, but there's lots of scientific data that says that. So those are important components. And if they need therapy, whether it's physical therapy or occupational therapy for sensory integration, that tends to really be helpful as well, particularly during infancy.
Thank you very much. We'll do that. So when they wave, I need to wave back, right?
Yes, correct. When they wave, you wave back. If they wave and you don't wave back, that's not serve and return. So, you know, it's little subtle things. It sounds like it turns out that our solutions are very simple, right? They are really simple. And the reason they're simple is because they are part of our behavioral repertoire. Humans are social creatures. And that's why Zoom is so challenging. My colleague Phil Fisher was on one of those videos, has just published a study on the impact of remote learning on child development, right, in this period of time. It's not good. We know it's not good, right? Because as much as I'm with you, I'm not with you, right? And for children, it's really, really, really challenging. So their interactions that they're having, like my wife's a retired school teacher. She's over with my grandchildren in another part of Los Angeles. I have two of our five are school age. And one's in fifth grade and one's in first grade. And she's with them, not to help them with their lessons or anything, but to be there and support them and for emotional support and be there to socially engage with them. She's there every day with them. It's made an enormous difference that social connectedness matters.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Doctor, just in the closing minutes here, we're almost done. I just wanted to see if you could comment very briefly about the cycles that are inherent in what you're describing, because you show statistics that, you know, a higher larger vocabulary leads to greater success academically, and it seems like put somebody on a better path, not just vocabulary, but various other things associated with the socioeconomic status of the family. But then somebody who's in that situation that is more likely to then have kids who themselves are going to be in that better situation that then, and you end up having those cycles. Can you just comment on that again, and just we're wrapping up at 10, but any final comments on that? Because that feels like such a critical piece for us as policymakers.
Yeah, so we know that what we scientists call intergenerational transmission, right? And so some of it is we know from basic science studies. There are actually, you know, stress to adults, even before the child is born, can change what we call the epigenetic signature, right? DNA is DNA. It has a sequence to it, and it encodes proteins. But you can modify that chemically. It's called epigenetic changes. And now those modifications are the things that change how a gene is used. That can happen in sperm, and that can happen in ova, in eggs as well. So that's one mechanism of passing on certain features. It turns out that it's not random in terms of the genes that get modified chemically. We know for a fact that genes that are responsible for our stress response get modified. So that's a bit scary, right? Because you're saying that these experiences that the adult is having, even before they conceive a child, can have an impact. And so that's one way. The other, of course, is that, you know, your learned style of social engagement and interaction is passed on, right, to children who become adults who have that same learned style of social engagement and interaction, or lack thereof. And that's another way of intergenerational transmission. But there's lots of studies now showing that generational stress gets turned into intergenerational stress. When we say stress, it's not about being anxious. You know, I stuttered when I was a child severely. So I had stress when I was in a classroom in terms of being afraid of being called on to have to read out loud. Or standing up at circle time. Lots of children are anxious about standing up at circle time. That's the normal stress that gets buffered by positive relationships, right? Support from parents that you can do this. It's okay. A hug, whatever it might be. That's the buffering capacity. The stress we're talking about is chronic.
Dr. Levitt, thank you so very much for this helpful presentation, for getting up so early with us. And we really appreciate you sharing your expertise. And members and members of the public, we will be back on Tuesday to build on this strong foundation that Dr. Levitt has given for us, just like the brain architecture he described. So thank you so much again. We really appreciate it. Everyone have a great weekend, and we'll look forward to seeing you on Tuesday at 8:30. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.